Now we go to our next topic, which is the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, and 12. This post-implementation review is a little bit further ahead than the IFRS 9 post-implementation review, and I give the floor to Sam, please.
Thank you, Martin. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you very well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hello, everyone. The last GPF meeting we joined for this project was October 2019, and this was the start of the post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, 12, when the board was obtaining the information to decide what matters it might examine further in the next step in the request for information. And before we start this session, let's recap on the objective of a post-implementation review, which is to assess the effect of new standards or major amendments on whether the standards are working as intended by the board. Let's turn to slide four for the timeline of this project. In December 2020, after considering the feedback from the first phase of the review, the board published a request for information with 150-day comment period, which will end on 10th of May. And we are now undertaking outreach of the matters for the board to decide what, if any, actions to take in the future. Let's go to slide six. At today's meeting, we would like to discuss some of the matters that we think could be of interest to preparers, which you can find on this slide. However, if members have comments on other matters covered by the request for information, or we have extra time left after discussing these matters, feel free to raise the matter. And I'll go through these matters one by one, starting with a brief introduction of the matter, what we heard in the first phase, and then seek your inputs, your experience on these areas. Next slide, please. The first topic relates to rights held by an investor that gave the investor power over an investee, or relating to the first element of the definition of control. In the first phase of the review, stakeholders say that assessing whether rights are protective rights can be challenging in some circumstances. For example, a franchise agreement, a franchisee may find it difficult to assess the rights held by the franchisor, whether the rights held by the franchisor is actually protective or not. Usually, these rights are related to the operation under the franchise agreement extensively sometimes. In addition, some stakeholders ask for additional guidance on reassessing its own rights or the rights held by other parties. This also include potential voting rights when facts and circumstances change, for example, for change in market conditions. So in the request for information, we'd like to understand that if any challenges you have encountered in this area in assessing whether rights give an investor power over an investee. So I will stop here and seek your inputs on this area, assessing the rights held by the investor.
One of the things that we've encountered is how to evaluate rights, such as, if you have a board seat, but the government imposes restrictions on what that board member can vote on, or parts of meetings that they can participate in or not participate in because of concerns over monopoly or things like that, where some governments will put a lot of restrictions on board members' ability to participate. So I think in general, a lot of the principles are good, but sometimes the facts make it difficult to maneuver through the assessment on control.
Okay, thanks, Sandy. Anybody else like to comment?
I mean, I can add, I think it functions probably as the board intended. I mean, after the standards were published, we acquired a company with 60% ownership, and previously we'd have just sort of consolidated it with an NCI and that's it. Whereas with this particular case, we had to go through quite detailed analysis of all these points to, despite the fact that we had a 60% shareholding, to sort of justify the treatment. And I don't think that's necessarily wrong to do that, but we had kind of similar questions where sort of things aren't necessarily quite as, I realize you can't anticipate every scenario when writing a standard, but sort of you get some quite complicated arrangements written into contracts, and you really have to spend quite a bit of time, or potentially have to spend quite a bit of time going through it. But I don't think that's necessarily wrong. That was our experience of it.
I think that's, even with mine, Ian, I think that's right. It's not necessarily wrong. I think it's important to go through that thoughtful process, but it can be complicated, and sometimes it's, you know, just a judgment call, and you spend a lot of time with the auditors as they try to, you know, apply their own judgment to things without really fully comprehending the environment in different countries.
Yeah, I think it's also a thing to bear in mind with these. You need to build in certain anti-abuse procedures, because while we were going through that process, it kind of struck me that it could be possible, but not relatively straightforward, to construct an arrangement where you do own 60% of a company and then you don't consolidate it. And bearing in mind the company that we acquired was actually loss-making at that time, I didn't tell anybody internally, but I can imagine there's some people might say, yeah, that's sort of, let's not consolidate it. So I think you just need to be a little bit careful with this about what actually you want to achieve. I mean, there is a certain merit to having something consolidated. And I think the idea that if you own more than 50%, there's a rebuttable consumption, a presumption that you should consolidate it. I think that's, to me, that's still a good starting point. But the standard does kind of push you away from that and challenges that a bit more.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Anybody else? Yes, please. You are on mute. Hear you. Still cannot hear you. Sorry. No, we cannot hear you. It's really not. Something is wrong. Anybody else while we're waiting? So Trinat is fixing the equipment.
I would say that we haven't had any situations where interpretation has resulted in an answer that was contrary to the gut. So it's, I think it's working as intended.
Trinat, will you try again? Cannot hear you. No, we cannot hear you. Okay, then let's move on. Thing.
Yeah, thank you, Martin. Thank you for your inputs. Next slide,
Martin,
please.
Martin, I think Mary wanted to make a comment, or?
It's okay, I'll hold.
Okay.
The second topic we would like to discuss is control without a majority voting rights. And for example, a situation when an investor holds less than 50% of ownership interest and other shareholdings are dispersed and there is no contractual agreement within these other shareholders, and the investor has a practical ability to direct the relevant activity of the investee. And in the first phase of the review, stakeholders say that this assessment could require significant judgment. Furthermore, some stakeholders said continuous reassessment of control can be costly to monitor the transactions or events within these other shareholders, see whether there's any changes in control decisions. And for this topic, we would like to understand first the frequency of this kind of, we call de facto control, and the challenges in the assessment of control. Therefore, the request for information is asking how often an investor is asked to apply the requirements to assess control without a majority of voting rights, and how costly it is to obtain the information, either in the initial assessment or in the continuous assessment of the control. I'll stop here to see if you have any experience on this area.
This is Sandy Melisic again. We have cases where this is the result where we have less than a majority and end up having to consolidate because of control. Oftentimes, though, we are the operator of the entity, and we can, or we're doing the accounting as well. So we've not had issues with obtaining financial information to do it. During the life cycle of an entity, the control can change, but typically we found that you know when those trigger events are going to happen. So one person may have more control during a project phase, but then when you get into operations, the control may shift to somebody else. And so I don't think you're reassessing all the time. Typically, I think it is a reassessment when there's a trigger due to change in events. It seems like it works as intended.
Okay, thanks, Sandy. Mary, do you want to...
Hi, can you hear me now?
Hi.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes, yes. I would like to add to the point what Sandy made here. The relevant activities do change over a time, which can lead to illogical changes in the accounting over time for an entity with a static governance structure. Therefore, it makes sense for this test to be applied by looking at the relevant activities of the entity over the life cycle of the entire project, rather than at one specific point of time, especially at the beginning of the project. So that is something which may have to be emphasized in the standard.
Okay, thanks.
This is Aki speaking.
Okay.
Martindi, can we maybe, if I give you the word, and if you want to say something, please use the chat, and then I will ask you to speak.
Okay.
Because everything, that's the order. First, Mary, please.
Thanks, and thanks, Martin. Just that the first round of comments are very helpful and highlighted what is, at least for me personally, big issues that we're going to have to weigh at the board when we consider the feedback we get from this RFI. For me, there are two kind of observations I make about this PIR. One is that judgment is important, and I think both Sandy and Ian's comments and on the first question emphasize that. And I think our challenge will be to assess whether there's an adequate framework for making the necessary judgments, you know, clear enough reference points, benchmarks, objectives, rather than trying to provide guidance for every situation, because I think both of them acknowledge that there are some very transaction-specific limits in contracts that they have to apply judgment to. And the second is, I think we just have to be careful to not try to address every possible application issue, because every time we add guidance, it increases the complexity of the standard for everybody who picks it up. And the reason, you know, Zen highlighted that there are several places where we're asking for information about the frequency with which issues come up, because what we're trying to do is figure out whether, if this is an area for which guidance is requested, we are benefiting many or relatively few. So, Martin, those were just two kind of contextual comments, but I think that they very much reflect the sentiments of the comments that GPF members have made already. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Ian?
Yeah, just a practical question on this one. I mean, we don't have the situation now, but we did have it a few years back, and we did own exactly the scenario that's on the screen. But the company where we had 48% was a US-listed company, and they didn't see it this way. They didn't actually let us have any financial information at all. So we actually treated it as an associate, and we had to consolidate it basically 3 months in arrears because they wouldn't send us any information. So if we'd have had to treat them as a subsidiary, and bear in mind we publish our results sort of in late January, we'd have been in real trouble with this. So I think there is a practical point that you can make this assessment and say, yeah, in practical purposes, maybe you can, but in pragmatically, you may not have that access. So I think you just need to be aware how people could actually deal with that in a real life situation.
Thanks, Ian. I think next is Iwaki. You wanted to say something earlier.
Yes, well, we experienced this kind of difficulties accessing to the information of ownership of investee. In some, you know, fast moving industry like a tech industry, you know, investee often do equity financing. Sometimes, you know, we cannot catch up with all the, you know, relevant information of, you know, other investors. In that case, you know, we may have difficulties in audit procedure or whether or not we should, you know, consolidate or not. So, yeah, in some industry, fast moving industry, you know, access to information may be sometimes difficult. Thank you.
Thanks, Iwaki. Srinath?
Yes, sorry, I wanted to add a couple of comments here, especially on relevant activities and substantive versus protective right, and lot of focus on the judgment involved. At the end of the day, it boils down to subjective judgment of CFOs and audit partner with their own biases and experience, especially in the analysis of relevant activities and substantive versus protective rights. Even in almost identical factual situations, I have seen the resulting outcome could be different. The main focus here is that you have to demonstrate beyond doubt that you have the current ability or unilateral ability to direct relevant activities, which may result in wrong outcomes in some situations. That is my experience. In addition to that, in any real M&A transaction, the controlling partners will need to offer their minority partners a reasonable level of protection. It is therefore not appropriate that standards should present consolidation merely, and items like setting the budget and business plan is a reserved matter at a JV board. We believe that the emphasis in the test should be in the ability to appoint management and give the overall direction to run the business rather than specific veto rights to be considered for control analysis.
Okay, thanks. Next is Xiaofeng. I think you are on mute, Xiaofeng. We cannot hear you. Still can't hear you, sorry. Maybe anybody else, and we come later back to Shaofeng.
Martin, I'm not sure how to get in the queue to be able to speak, and I apologize for that.
If you have a phone, you can speak.
Okay. The I think Serna made a good point. When you have public entities that you would be required to consolidate, and they haven't issued their financial information yet, there should be a mechanism to be able to do a 3-month lag in the reporting or address it some other in some other manner. We've had to address that in the past, and it's always been a bit uncomfortable to be able to determine an approach that wouldn't put the company at risk for providing us non-public information.
Yeah. Okay, Srinath?
Yes, another broader point I would like to highlight here is, I think one of the objectives of IFRS 10 to come out with a principle-based approach for consolidation is to avoid any companies to have off-balance sheet special purpose vehicles. But based on the analysis or principles laid in the standard, it would be easier for a company not to consolidate an entity by giving some of the substantive rights to a minority partner on the paper. So I'm not sure how that problem has been resolved in IFRS 10. It's a broader, much broader question, not specific to any particular section within the standard. So I don't know whether that is still achieved in the current standard.
Okay. So, anybody else? Not the case, and we're going later back to Shaofeng, but now maybe move ahead with Zeng. Next slides.
Thank you. Let's move on to the another element of a control definition, i.e. how to assess if a decision maker is a principal agent. IFRS 10 requires the decision maker to consider the overall relationship between the self and the investee to determine whether it is a principal agent. We have heard in some cases in the first phase of review, stakeholders find it challenging to assess the decision maker's exposure to variable returns, for example, due to the complexity of the remuneration arrangement, but typically in the fund managing industry. In this area, the primary focus of the questions in the request for information is to understand the frequency and challenges, if any, of applying these principal agent relationship assessment, these criteria, different weightings in different scenarios. So let me hand back over to the members for your inputs.
Okay. Anybody? But in the meantime, Shaofeng is back. Do you want to maybe try again to make your comments?
Can you hear? Can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Okay, just give three mentions for IFRS 10. One is for the transaction with NCI. Some subsidiaries do not meet the definition of the business. For example, the subsidiary hold part of a pipeline, a warehouse, or under construction, or a property to be sold, etc. will the parent acquire the remaining equity stake from NCI and IFRS 10, paragraph 23? The difference from between what is paid and the proportionate share of the subsidiary net assets should be accounted for in equity. It is because IFRS 10 does not distinguish whether the subsidiary is a business or an asset. In my view, the substance of the transaction is the parents paying a premium for the remaining stake of the underlying assets. Therefore, the premium should be recorded as assets cost and not disappear in the equity. So I think this issue is prevalent in real life, especially when the definition of the business in the amended IFRS 3 become effective. This is the first I want to mention. The second is I want to share how to define relevant activities. The life cycle of like my business, the oil and gas operation, spans through many different phases, including like exploration, development, and production. The relevant activity and the decision-making mechanism and each phase can be totally different. So how do we define relevant activity for this operation? Do we break it down by phase? The result is we consolidate and deconsolidate in different phase, or do we look at it for the entire life cycle? This is an issue we face not only on our domestic operation, but especially in international operation. So there is now no guidance in the standard. We need to clarify of this. So this is two things I want to share. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the comment, Xiaofeng. Then let's go back to the principal and agent questions, and maybe Srinath, you want to comment? Anybody on the phone want to comment on this principal agent? Also not the case, then I give the word back to the thing.
Thank you, Martin. Before moving on to IFRS 11, I would leave floor for member to see, do you have any additional comments on IFRS 10? Because we are going to cover IFRS 11 for the next few slides. Okay, if not the case, let's move on to the IFRS 11. Next slide, please, Wayne. The first matter about is about collaborative arrangements that outside the scope of IFRS 11. The definition of a joint arrangement in IFRS 11 requires a presence of joint control. However, multiple partners may act together in an unincorporated arrangement, in which case joint control cannot be identified. For example, when only a majority of voting rights required to direct certain type of relevant activity in this arrangement. So we understand that in practice, to account for these kind of collaborative arrangements that outside the scope of IFRS 11, an analogy is made usually by the preparer to joint operation accounting, that is to recognize the share of assets and liabilities, the share of revenue and expenses, and et cetera. And once again, the board is first seeking to understand the frequency of this kind of so-called collaborative arrangement outside scope of IFRS 11, and then what the current accounting practice is based on your experience. I will stop here to see if you have any inputs on this collaborative arrangement outside scope of 11.
So anybody has experience in collaborative arrangements?
I have a question. I don't know if you can help me with it, but in some joint operations, certain things are done by joint decision making, but there are other things that may require supermajority, but not 100% approval, or some things are made by, some decisions are made with different levels of approval of the members. How does that put you in the collaborative arrangement category, or how do you end up in the collaborative arrangement category versus a joint operation?
I would say maybe not, because my understanding is the definition of joint control is depending on the definition of control. So you still have to analyze these relevant activity, who are directing this activity, this kind of thing. What we heard in the first phase regarding this collaborative arrangement is about the relevant activity. Let's say the relevant activity is clear, but the relevant activity is directed by majority voting rights, which may be a different combination of joint partners can decide these relevant activities. That's why there's no joint control that can be identified in this scenario. That's why it's outside scope of IFRS 11, because the lack of joint control. This is what we heard in the first phase. But we would like to understand more, like what's the typical feature of this collaborative arrangement, to see whether we can do something to put them in the standard.
Okay.
Yes, I'm still struggling to think of an example where you would have a collaborative arrangement that wasn't a joint operation, but it could be just our industry is a little bit different. I don't know if you can give an example that might be helpful.
Okay. And I'm seeing in the chat room that there maybe is not a lot of experience with this collaborative arrangements, but Murillo has a question. Murillo, please. I cannot hear you. Maybe you are mute. Still cannot hear you. Okay, you are not on mute, but you still cannot. Sorry.
Martin, maybe let me explain a little bit more on these examples. But you can look at this slide deck. On the left-hand side, we have this example. So for a typical joint operation arrangement, A, B, C, D, it requires the unilateral agreement between A, B, C, and D. But if this is a collaborative arrangement, it only requires, for example, 70% of voting rights to decide a certain type of relevant activity, which means there are four combinations, A, B, C, B, C, D, etc., that these three partners can decide the decision making. So basically, there's no one single combination. That's why it's for outside the scope of IFRS 11. But I think maybe the stakeholders in the first phase explained that they think the business substance for them from their perspective is similar to what they have for joint operation. That's why they use an analogy to joint operation accounting.
Yeah, I think that's the important point that we've heard, is that for these collaborative arrangements, even though they might be outside the scope of IFRS 11, the accounting practice is to apply joint operation accounting.
We have a situation under U.S. GAAP that in the end, our collaborative arrangement, the auditor said, oh, you just account for it the same as you would an undivided joint interest, which would be your joint operations accounting. So I think if it could be wrapped in, it would be helpful. We could have joint operations, and then if you decide to do an expansion, but only three partners want to participate in the expansion, so the output of that expansion and then is only allocated to those three partners, that we would still view the whole thing as a joint operation and split it up into two separate allocation methodologies. I don't know if that was understandable, but.
Okay, thanks, Sandy. Ian?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if this is what you're driving at. And if it isn't, then you can just stop me. But I mean, we have a lot of these kind of collaborative arrangements in the pharmaceuticals industry. So for example, you could have a situation where one company will invent a medicine and they will sell it and market it in the US, and they will come to somebody like us and we'll sort of take the marketing rights for outside the US, and there'll be various milestones and cost sharing arrangements for research and maybe marketing and maybe even a profit share arrangement. The underlying intellectual property is still owned by the original company, so this is all just built on top of that. But that kind of arrangement I've just described isn't really captured by any additional disclosures at all. I think you have, you assess the various bits of it on a case-by-case basis, and you end up booking the sales or not, depending on that, how the agreement's written, and you sort of do the true-ups through M&D and R&D based on the cost-sharing. But is this the kind of thing you're driving at here, or am I going the wrong way?
So I think we have heard there are some arrangements in the pharmaceutical industry that might be captured by this notion of collaborative arrangements that we've used in the RFI, but we've also been told that they are more associated with the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, I mean, Sandy can maybe come back. I think the ones in oil and gas may be much more sort of structured, and they're much more sort of have a longer term formalistic structure. But certainly I can tell you the investors in the pharma sector are very interested in this kind of disclosure, much more so than a lot of the other disclosures in the financial statements. And actually the existing standards don't require the preparer to say very much at all about these.
If you need additional input, I'm part of an international or IFRS oil and gas committee, and we could set up a call with that group of companies to provide further input.
I think that would be really, really helpful.
Okay. If you want to reach out to me afterwards, I'll get you connected with the person that's hosting the next meeting.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And similarly, if you're interested in what goes on in pharma, I can take a call.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Then we should go to joint arrangements. Jing?
Yeah, thank you. Second IFRS 11 matters classification of joint arrangements. Some stakeholders says classifying joint arrangements are either joint operation or joint ventures can require significant judgment. For example, for a joint arrangement is structured through a separate vehicle and other facts and circumstances indicate the arrangement. So its substance is actually a joint operation. So in the view of these stakeholders, the requirements in IFRS 11 should be simpler to apply in this area of other facts and circumstances. So the board is requesting information regarding how frequently an investor is asked to consider other facts and circumstances to classify an arrangement that is structured through a separate vehicle, of course. And if there are additional factors that are not in the standard and may be relevant in the assessment of the classification. I will hand back over to the members for your inputs.
Okay, Liliana.
Thank you very much. The issue that we are facing is relating really the classification itself, because it's really based on the legal form, and it's based on legal forms that maybe in some geographies does not exist. We didn't experience too much issues relating to joint venture and joint operation because in our industry we tend to control the activity, and I didn't say that, but with control we have no problem. But today, with the sustainability issues and the sustainability program that we are facing, everybody, most of the sustainable project and sustainable solutions need to be done in a joint venture, where each partner puts their own knowledge, their own expertise together. Of course, the result of this project will be for something that is common. The control is a joint control, and the vehicle cannot, in every case, respond to the issue related to what we intend to do. That means to put everybody its own expertise in order to provide a solution that is not very common in the market. I have really issues. This is one point. And the second comment that I want to make is that talking about this issue for many years with the auditors, we are not very, the joint operation classification is not very common. Really, the economic result or the economic intention or the economic reality of such a joint venture, as I was mentioning to you, are captured with a joint operation, but we are not reaching the joint operation classification because it's based on legal form. There is no many countries that the legal form that they have a legal form where the entity, the legal entity is transparent. This is my main comment relating to that.
Okay. Thanks, Liliana. Anybody else wants to comment?
This is Sandy again. This is very common in our industry, and some countries specifically require you to have a legal entity, but underneath the legal entity, you try to get back to a situation that's very common to undivided joint interests, where you have ownership in the individual assets and obligations. So I would say it's fairly common in our industry, and this is another one that perhaps it'd be helpful to talk to an industry group to get broader input.
Okay, next is Murillo.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, great. I had to change my mic. So here, anything works now. What I'd like to comment on that is that I didn't have the opportunity to see this happening many times, the situation in which we have a separate vehicle and having to analyze facts and circumstances to see if it is a joint operation. But even though it's not frequent, I did see in the past this happening. And what I recall was that it was kind of difficult to apply the requirements of IFRS 11 to analyze these facts and circumstances, trying to come up with whether the separate vehicle is a joint operation or not. From the case that I remember, a part of these facts and circumstances were expectations, and dealing with expectations was a little bit hard to sustain that these facts and circumstances really should end up in rights and obligations being recognized by the joint controller, which I think is a very, very unique way of treating these rights and obligations.
Okay. Anybody else wants to comment? No. Go ahead, Chen.
Thank you. The last matter we'd like to cover in detail is accounting requirements for joint operations. There are cases in which joint operators are committed to buying a share of the output of the joint operation that differs from their share of the ownership in the joint operation. Maybe sometimes in a certain stage of the life cycle of the joint operation. Some of these questions have been addressed by the IFRS Interpretations Committee, and the request for information is asking if there are situations you believe in which applying the requirements in relation to joint operation accounting that does not result in information that is relevant or faithful? And more importantly, why do you think so? I will hand over back to members.
Who would like? William?
Thank you. I cannot judge whether the information is more or less relevant than what we would have had we applied different requirements. But there's something that I think particularly difficult to understand is the difference that we might have in the accounting for transactions, depending on whether we do have joint control or not. When I apply these other facts and circumstances criteria to determine whether I should recognize assets and liabilities in the balance sheet of the joint controller, this is a different way of approach the recognition of assets and liabilities than what we would have had we if we were talking about a subsidiary that we controlled. So under the same facts and circumstances, we would have different accounting treatments depending on whether we do have a subsidiary or a joint arrangement. And that's something I don't know what is more relevant or less relevant, but there is a difference there. And I don't think it's something really explainable. Why is that different?
Morello, I think we have some background noise. Can please, Eddie, everybody mute the mics when you are not speaking? That would be really good. Okay, any further comments? No. Not the case, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. Slide 13 actually lists the other matters we haven't covered in detail, but we did included them in the request for information. They're actually of the same importance. And so I would ask members to see if you have any additional comments on these other topics. Let me explain a little bit. The first one, we probably have touched a little bit about the identifying relevant activity of investee. And second one is identifying non-contractual agency relationship, which means a normal situation is they, like say, two companies under common control, they both of them, each of them holds a certain percentage of ownership interest of an investee. And it's not easy for these two companies to decide which one actually control the investee, despite the parent company, of course, control the investee through these two companies. But from the perspective of these two companies, it's not easy to decide which one controls the investee. And the third one is covers the changes in relationship between the investor and some of the transactions or events that changes the relationship between the investor and the investee are actually silent in the standard. So we are trying to understand whether these gaps in the standards are frequently arise or infrequently arise, and any common accounting practice from your experience. The fourth one is related to a comment made by Xiaofeng. It's partial acquisition of a subsidiary that does not constitute a business, and basically people asking about whether to recognize a non-controlling interest in this situation, because IFRS 10 does not distinguish between a business and non-business subsidiary. And next two items relate to the consolidation exemption for investment entity. One is people say that the criteria to be identified as an investment entity are not so easy to apply. Sometimes they need more specific criteria to look at. And next one is related to a multi-layer structure of an investment entity parent when the fair value measurement of the subsidiary of this investment entity parent sometimes subsumes all the information that is underlying, that related to underlying investment held indirectly through this subsidiary. So people sometimes complain about the lack of information because of the multi-layer of structure. And the last one is about the IFRS 12 disclosure requirements. So maybe from the perspective of preparers, are you aware of any disclosure requirements that is costly to prepare or extremely difficult to prepare, something like that? So I will hand over back to you to see, do you have any comments on these other matters?
Okay, first is Srinath. Srinath, we cannot hear you.
Sorry. Yeah, the first item I have already highlighted the difficulty, especially when the relevant activities change over the life cycle of a project where you have invested money in. So that is something which requires clarification, whether you assess the relevant activities at the beginning of a project or over the life of a project, which needs to be taken into account for control assessment. Generally, the control assessments are done at the beginning of a project, and that is something which requires clarification.
Okay, thanks. Any further? I cannot believe that you don't have comments on disclosure requirements. Murillo.
Yes, since you mentioned it, my comment is that I know the standard has paragraphs to help dealing with aggregation and disaggregation, but despite the existence of these paragraphs, the feeling that we have is that the way the main paragraphs listing the disclosure requirements are written give the impression that these disclosure requirements should be all compliant with as a checklist. So maybe one alternative would be thinking of a different wording for, I think paragraphs B12 and B13, I'm not sure. But maybe thinking of a different wording to make sure that these paragraphs, they don't sound like a checklist that should be all ticked and to make sure that everything is disclosed, but something that should be saw as more as an example or a suggestion of things that should be complied with, depending on the aggregation and disaggregation requirements.
Okay, thanks. Any further comments on these other matters? Richard?
I think it would be useful to address what I think it's in the KPMG guide. There's a reference to the anticipated acquisition method, which is when there's a non-controlling interest where there are both puts and calls on that non-controlling interest. We found that guidance useful. You might want to look at that and see if it should be incorporated into a standard or guidance.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Ian?
Yeah, I thought I had to react to your remark about the disclosure. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I don't have a particular issue with the disclosures in IFRS 12 because I kind of get why they're relevant and I get why people would need them. It's more the disclosures in some of the other standards that just sort of become burdensome. But I mean, someone else can contradict me if they maybe feel differently, but I was reasonably comfortable with these disclosures and I get it why they're there.
Thank you for that comment, Ian. Anybody else? It's not the case. Then I think we are done with post-implementation review of 10.11.12. Is that right, Seng? Okay. Good. We are a little bit ahead of time. I would then recommend that we take now a 15 minutes break, that we are back at 1:15, and maybe somebody should inform Mariella that we start a little bit earlier. Okay, let's have a break until 1:15. Thanks.
Thank you.